Sensing this, Lobia had told her with a wrinkled smile, "Shaddam loves his reins of power far more than he could ever love any woman, my lady. It is not me he is interested in. It is what I have to tell him. The emperor worries about enemies at every turn and wants to know if they are lying to him, scheming to take his power, his wealth, even his life." As the years went by and Anirul gave him no male heir, Shaddam had grown even more distant toward her. Before long, he would probably dispose of her and secure another wife who would dutifully bear him a son. His father Elrud had done that enough times. But unknown to Shaddam, Anirul had already introduced an undetectable agent into her husband during their infrequent sexual sessions. After 5 daughters, he would never conceive another child. The emperor was sterile, now that he and Anirul had served the sisterhood's purposes. Shaddam IV had been with enough other women that he should have been able to guess his condition. But the man would never consider that something might be wrong with him, not when he could blame someone else. As all of this came back to her, Anirul opened her eyes and scribbled furiously with the virtual pen. But again she paused, thinking she heard something. Someone talking in the corridor outside? Stealthy footsteps? She listened carefully, but heard nothing more. She rolled the virtual writing implement in her hand, and heard the noises again, louder this time, as if people were inside the room with her. Whispers rose to incomprehensible sentence fragments, and then drifted off. Nervously, Anirul left the desk and searched the empty closets, the largest trunks, any place where someone might be hiding. Again, nothing. The voices grew louder, and with a start, Anirul finally recognized a new clamor from other memory, an increasingly unruly surge. She had never experienced such an outpouring before, and wondered what had triggered it. Her own search? The turmoil of her troubled thoughts? This time the voices seemed to be around her, as well as inside. The echoes rose in volume, as if she were in a chamber filled with argumentative sisters. But she could see none of them, and could not understand their garbled, overlapping conversation. Each one had something to say, but the words were confusing, contradictory. Anirul considered fleeing Lobia's empty apartment, but thought better of it. If the multitude within was trying to contact her, attempting to say something important, she needed to learn what it was. "Lobia, are you there?" In response, the storm of words shifted like a ghostly cloud. Voices faded and grew louder, like poorly tuned comm signals struggling through a raging static discharge. Some of the long-dead women screamed to be heard over the others, but still Anirul could not comprehend. They seemed to be calling out the various names of the Kwisatz Haderach in many languages. Suddenly, all sound diminished inside her head. Anirul's head rang with a disquieting silence, and she felt a sick cramping in her stomach. She stared at the sensory conceptual journal still hovering above the desk. The previous time that she had detected agitation in other memory, she had also been writing in her journal. At that time she had probed deeply into that realm, only to find herself blocked by a swirling mist. The two experiences were different, but she received the same message from each. Something was wrong in the clamorous throng of her female ancestors. This time the incomprehensible voices were even more disturbed, coming unbidden. If she did not discover why, her life, or worse, the Kwisatz Haderach program, which was her entire reason for existence, might be in grave danger. Once you have explored a fear, it becomes less terrifying. Part of courage comes from extending our knowledge. Duke Leto Atreides. As an afternoon wind picked up over the Sea of Caladan, Leto leaned his elbows on a balcony table. He liked to sit out in the salty air, watching lines of thunderclouds roll across the choppy waves. The great storms at sea were at once terrifying and glorious, bringing to mind the turmoils in the Imperium and in his heart, reminding him of how insignificant a mere duke was against forces greater than himself. On the other side of the table, facing the stone wall instead of the sea, Prince Romber did not feel the cold with his cyborg body. Rather, he studied an ornate board of Cheops, a strategy game of pyramid chess that Leto had often played with his father. "It is your move, Leto." The Duke's mug of strong tea had grown cold, but he took a drink anyway. He moved his vanguard piece, a Cymec warrior set up to ward off the approach of his opponent's Black Priest. "I mean it's your move in another sense, too." Romber stared past him at lines in the ancient stone block walls. "The Bene Gesserit have turned down your request for the invisible ship. But we cannot stop there. Now that Thufir and Gurney have returned with their report, we have all the information we need. The time has come for genuine action to recapture my place on Ix." He gave a boyish grin on his scarred face. "And with Jessica gone, you need something useful to occupy yourself." "You may be right." Leto stared off to sea, not smiling at the joke. Ever since the Skyclipper explosion, he had looked for a dramatic goal to keep himself steady. The punitive strike on Baikal had been a good first step, but not enough. He still felt only a fraction of a man, like Romber. "Still, I must consider the welfare of my own people first," Leto said thoughtfully. "Many of my soldiers would die in an attack on Ix, and we need to bear in mind the security of Caladan as well. If the attack were to fail, the Sardaukar would be down our throats here. I want to save your world, not lose my own." "I know it'll be dangerous. Great men take great risks, Leto." Romber hit his fist on the table with more force than he'd intended. The pieces on the Cheops board jumped as if an earthquake had rocked their tiny world. Then, looking down at his prosthetic hand, he raised it carefully from the table. "Sorry." His expressions were more dramatic than before, more emotionally charged. "My father, mother, and sister are dead. I am more machine than flesh, can never have children. What in the hells do I have to lose?" Leto waited for him to finish. The prince was building up a head of steam, as he often did when the subject of Ix came up. The only good result of the terrible tragedy of the Skyclipper explosion was that it seemed to have galvanized his mind and made it more clear. He was much more forceful now, with clear-cut goals and timetables he wanted to meet. He was a man, a new man, on a mission. "Emperor Shaddam's conditional amnesty was an empty gesture, and I was lulled into complacency by accepting it. For years, I kept convincing myself that things would get better if I just waited. Well, my people can wait no longer." He made as if to slam his fist on the tabletop again, but when Leto flinched, Romber stopped himself. His face softened, taking on a pleading expression. "It's been too damned long, Leto, and I just want to go. Even if all I do is slip inside and find Kater, together we could foster an uprising from the downtrodden populace." Romber stared at the Cheops board, with its multiple levels and complexities that mirrored life in so many ways. He reached out with his prosthetic hand, pressed his fingers together, and picked up a delicately carved sorceress game piece, which he moved across the board. "Ix will repay you every solari for the military campaign, plus a generous interest rate. In addition, I could have Ixian technicians come to Caladan and go over all your systems, industry, government, transportation, fishing, farming. and provide your people with advice on how to improve them. Systems are the key, my friend, along with the latest technology, of course. We could provide the necessary Ixion machines, too, at no charge for an agreed-upon period of time, say 10 years or even 20. We could work it out. Knitting his eyebrows, Leto studied the board and made his move, sliding a highliner piece up a level to capture his opponent's navigator. With only a casual glance at the board, Romber said, "Every house in the Landsraad, including House Atreides, will benefit from the overthrow of the Tleilaxu. Once considered the most reliable and ingenious in the universe, now break down, since quality control is laughable in the Tleilaxu-run manufactories. And who can trust Tleilaxu products, even when they do work?" Since the return of the spy team, Leto had continued to ponder the many questions the information had raised. If the Tleilaxu were not driven back, they would undoubtedly use their foothold to create mischief throughout the Imperium. What were they doing with the Ixion armament factories? The Tleilaxu could form new armies and equip them with the latest military technology. And why were the Sardaukar there? A terrible thought occurred to Leto. Under the traditional balance of power in the Imperium, House Corino and its Sardaukar were the approximate equal militarily of the combined great houses of the Landsraad. What if Shaddam intended to tip that balance in his favor by allying himself with the Tleilaxu? Is that what they were doing on Ix? Leto turned away from the board. "You are right, Romber. No more games." His face became serious. "I no longer care about court politics or appearances, or how history might judge me. Justice is my main concern, and the future of the Landsraad, including House Atreides." He captured another of Romber's Cheops pieces, but the cyborg prince didn't seem to notice. Leto continued, "However, I want to be sure you are not intending to make an extravagant but empty gesture, as your father wanted to do. His ill-fated atomic attack on Kytane would have sent traumatic ripples through the Imperium, and it would have gained House Vernius nothing." Using neck servos, Romber nodded his heavy head. "It would have brought howling Avengers down on me. And on you as well, Leto, by association." Then he made a quick move in the game, a strategic blunder, enabling Leto to move another level up the Cheops pyramid. "A good leader must pay attention to details, Romber." The Duke tapped the pyramid chessboard, chiding him. "Great plans count for nothing if all the threads don't hold together." Romber flushed. "My skills at the Balisset are better than at games." Leto took another sip of his cold tea, then sloshed the liquid over the balcony edge. "This will not be simple or straightforward. Yes, I think the rebellion must begin from within. But there will also be an overt attack from the outside. Everything must be coordinated precisely." The wind picked up as the squall approached. Out on the water, coracles and fishing boats puttered back to the dock, trying to beat the oncoming rain. In the village below, men worked to stow loose components, tie down sails, and anchor their craft against the storm. A servant hurried out to take the empty teacup and the tray of sandwiches she had brought an hour before. A matronly woman with frizzy, straw-colored hair, she frowned at the ominous storm clouds. "You must come in now, my Duke." "Today I feel like staying out until the last possible moment." "Besides," Romber piped up, "I haven't beaten him yet." Leto gave an exaggerated moan. "Then we'll be out here all night." After the servant retreated, throwing a disapproving frown over her shoulder, Leto fixed Romber with a determined gaze. "While you work on the Ixion underground, I will mobilize military forces and prepare for a full-scale assault. I won't let you go alone, my good friend. Gurney Halleck will accompany you. He's a great fighter and smuggler, and he's already been inside Ix. Gray daylight glinted off the metal cap on Romber's skull as he nodded. I would not turn down his assistance. He and Gurney often played Balisset together and sang. Cian Nobleman often practiced for hours at a time to help his coordination, using his cyborg fingers to strum the gentle strings adeptly, though his singing voice never improved. Gurney was also a friend of my father's. He'll want revenge almost as much as I do. Leto's black hair whipped in the wind. Duncan will provide you with covert equipment and weapons. A camouflaged combat pod hidden in the Ixian wilderness can cause a lot of damage if used properly. Before you go, we'll work out a precise date and time for our full military assault from the outside, to coordinate it with your uprising from within. You punch the enemy in the belly, and while he's bent over, my troops will deliver the finishing blow. Romber moved another game piece as they discussed troop movements and weaponry. After all this time, the Tleilaxu would not expect an outright frontal attack, but their Sardaukar allies would be another story. Leto reached forward to pick up a perfectly detailed Sardaukar captain and moved it from the base of the pyramid all the way to the top. I love to see you enthralled with plans, Romber. It occupies your mind, focuses your thoughts. He toppled Romber's most important piece, the Carino Emperor sitting on a tiny representation of the Golden Lion Throne. And when you don't pay attention to your game, it's far easier for me to win. The prince smiled, rippling a scar on his cheek. You're a formidable foe indeed. It is my great honor and good fortune that we're allies on the field of battle. Man participates in all cosmic events. Emperor Idris I, Legacies of Kaitain. For each day Jessica spent at the imperial court, Lady Anirul found something even more extravagant to show her. The young concubine was ostensibly a lady-in-waiting to serve the emperor's wife, but Anirul treated her more like a guest, rarely giving her anything important to do. In an evening's entertainment at the Hussack III Center for the Performing Arts, Jessica rode with the emperor and his lady in a private coach. Exquisite enameled vehicle was drawn by enormous Harmonthep lions, whose creamy fur and wide paws were more suited to traversing rugged mountains than the streets of the most glorious city in the Imperium. As crowds lined the boulevards, the trained animals padded along, their muscles rippling in the pastel light of sunset. For public events such as this, teams of manicurists maintained the saber-like claws, while groomers shampooed the lion's fur and brushed their manes. Attired in a scarlet jacket and gold trousers, Shaddam sat stony-faced in the front of the shielded carriage. He did not strike Jessica as having a particular fondness for plays or operas, but his advisers must have pointed out the benefits of portraying himself as a cultured leader. Anirul and Jessica, clearly subordinate, rode in the rear seat. During Jessica's time on Kaitain, the emperor had not spoken more than a few sentences to her. She doubted he even remembered her name. She was, after all, merely a lady-in-waiting, pregnant, and of little interest. The three eldest imperial princesses, Irulan, Chalice, and Wensicia, traveled in a less ornate and unshielded vehicle behind them. Josepha and Rugi remained with caretakers. The imperial coaches pulled up in front of the column-studded edifice of the Hussack III Center, a cavernous building designed with acoustic enhancements and prismatic windows. Spectators could see and hear performances from the most creative talents in the Imperium, without missing a whisper or nuance, even sitting in the most distant seats. Veined marble arches with flanking fire fountains marked an entrance reserved for the emperor and his retinue. The fountains spewed feathery arcs of perfumed oils, Blue flames consumed much of the fuel before the droplets fell into the lozenge-shaped reflecting pools. Hasik III, one of the first rulers to settle on Kytane after the destruction of Seleucia Secundus, had taxed his subjects nearly into bankruptcy in order to rebuild a governmental infrastructure. Members of the Landsrat, vowing not to be outdone by House Corino, had built their own monuments in the growing city. Within a generation, unremarkable Kytane had become an awesome spectacle of imperial architecture, museums, and bureaucratic self-indulgence. The Performing Arts Center was only one example. Preoccupied, Anirul looked up at the imposing building, then turned her round eyes toward Jessica. "When you become a reverend mother, you will experience the wonders of other memory. In my collective past," she raised a slender hand, devoid of rings or other jewelry, and made a graceful, all-encompassing gesture. "I remember when this was built. The first performance here was an ancient and rather amusing play, Don Quixote." Jessica raised her eyebrows. In class, Mohiam had drilled her for years, teaching her culture and literature, politics and psychology. "Don Quixote seems an odd choice, my lady, especially after the tragedy on Seleucia Secundus." Anirul looked at her husband's profile as he gazed out the coach window. Shaddam was engrossed in the brassy fanfare and the crowds waving pennants in his honor. "Back then, emperors permitted themselves to have a sense of humor," she said. The imperial party stepped from their coaches and passed through the arched entryway, followed by a train of attendants who carried a long whale fur cape for the emperor. Ladies in waiting draped a similar, though less impressive, fur-lined shawl around Anirul's shoulders. The retinue entered the center for the performing arts with slow precision, so that the spectators and news imagers could capture every detail. Shaddam marched up a cascade of polished stairs to the spacious imperial box, close enough to the stage that he would be able to see the pores on the actors' faces, if he bothered to pay attention. Seated himself in a cushioned wing seat that had been sculpted to smaller proportions in order to make the emperor look large and dominating. Without a word to her husband, Anirul sat on his left and continued her conversation with Jessica. "Have you ever seen a performance by a registered company of jongleurs?" Jessica shook her head. "Is it true that master jongleurs have supernatural powers, enabling them to wring raw emotions from even the hardest heart?" "The jongleur talent appears to be a resonance hypnosis technique, similar to what the sisterhood uses, except these players use it merely to enhance their performances." With a toss of her bronze hair, Jessica said, "Then I look forward to experiencing the enhanced play. Tonight they would see my father's shadow, one of the finest post-Butlerian pieces of literature, a work that had done much to secure Crown Prince Raphael Corino's place in history as a revered hero and respected scholar." Escorted by Sardaukar guards, valets entered the imperial box and offered goblets of sparkling wine to the emperor, then to his wife and her guest. Anirul handed one of the fluted glasses to Jessica. "A fine Caladan vintage, part of the shipment your duke sent as a gift to thank us for watching over you." She reached over to touch Jessica's slightly rounded belly. "Though I dare say he didn't seem pleased to have you come here, based upon what Mohiam told me." Jessica flushed. "I'm sure Duke Atreides has enough business to distract him from wistful thoughts about a mere concubine." She maintained a placid expression, so as not to show the pain of missing him. "I'm sure he has some grand ambition planned." The valets vanished with their wine just as the orchestra struck up the overture and the play began. Shimmering floodlights bathed the stage, tuned yellow to imply sunrise. The set had no markings, props, or curtains. The acting troop marched out in a phalanx and found their marks. Jessica studied the lush costumes, the fabric embellished with splendid mythological designs. Shaddam sat in his chair, not quite bored, but Jessica guessed that would come soon enough. Following tradition, the performers waited until the Emperor nodded for them to proceed. Behind the stage, a technician activated a bank of solido hollow generators, and suddenly the props and sets shimmered into visibility. A towering castle wall, a throne, a thick stand of trees in the distance. "Ah, Imperium! Glorious Imperium!" exclaimed the lead actor playing Raphael. Carrying a long scepter topped by a faceted glow globe, he had thick, dark hair that flowed to the center of his back. His stocky, muscular body gave him a commanding presence. The face had a porcelain beauty that stirred Jessica. "My eyes are not strong enough, and my brain not spacious enough, to see and learn about all the wonders that my father rules." The actor lowered his head. "Would that I could devote my life to study, so that I might die with even a glimmer of understanding. In that way I could best honor God and my forefathers, who have made the Imperium great, who have stamped out the scourge of thinking machines." He raised his head, and with a piercing gaze looked squarely at Shaddam. "To be born a Carino is more blessing than any man deserves." Jessica felt a chill on her skin. The actor's delivery was rich and sonorous, yet he had altered the traditional words slightly. From her studies, she was certain that she remembered every line of the classic play. If Lady Anirule noticed the modified soliloquy, though, she said nothing of it. The female lead character, a beautiful woman named Harade, rushed on stage to interrupt the Crown Prince's reverie and inform him of an assassination attempt upon his father, the Padishah Emperor Idris I. Shocked, young Raphael sank to his knees and began to weep, but Harade clutched his hand.
"No, no, my prince, he is not yet dead. Your father survives, though he has suffered a grievous head wound."
"Idris is the light that makes the golden lion throne shine across the universe. I must see him. I must rekindle that ember and keep him alive." Harade said,
"Then let us make haste. The Sukh doctor is with him already."
Solemnly, they left the stage together. Within moments, the holoscenery shifted to an interior room. As he watched from his box, Shaddam leaned back with a heavy sigh. In the play, Emperor Idris failed to recover from his injury or awaken from his coma. Yet, life support systems kept him alive. Idris remained in the imperial bed, tended round the clock. Raphael Corino, de facto ruler and rightful heir to the throne, grieved for his father, but never formally took his place. Raphael never sat in the imperial throne, but always seated himself on a smaller chair. Though he commanded the Imperium for years, he never called himself anything other than Crown Prince. "I shall not usurp my father's throne, and woe to any parasite who considers it." The actor stepped closer to the imperial box. The faceted glow globe atop his staff was a shimmering jewel like a cold geological torch. He blinked, trying to assess precisely which lines the actor had altered and why. She saw something strange in his movements, a certain tension. Was he only nervous? Perhaps he had forgotten his lines. But a jongleur would never forget his lines. "House Corino is more powerful than the ambition of any individual. No one man can claim to own that heritage for himself." The actor rapped his staff on the stage. "Such hubris would be folly indeed." Now Anirule began to notice the mistakes herself and flashed a glance at Jessica. Shaddam just looked sleepy. The actor portraying the enlightened Raphael took a second step forward, just below the Emperor's box, while the other jongleurs faded back, giving him center stage.
We all have parts to play in the grand performance of the Imperium. He then digressed completely from the script and recited from a Shakespeare play, words even more ancient than my father's shadow. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Raphael reached to his breast and yanked off a ruby brooch. The gem had been ground down so that it looked like a lens. "And Shaddam, I am much more than an actor," he said, startling the Emperor into awareness. He slammed the faceted ruby into a socket on the staff, and Jessica realized it was a power source. An emperor should love his people, serve them, and work to protect them. Instead, you chose to become the butcher of Xanavar. The glow globe atop his staff blazed intensely bright. "If you wanted to kill me, Shaddam, I would gladly have given my life for all the people of Xanavar." Sardaukar stepped forward to the edge of the stage, not certain what to do. "I am your half-brother, Tyros Repha, son of Elrud the Ninth by Lady Shando Balut. I am the man you tried to murder when you destroyed a planet, slaying millions of innocents. And I challenge your right to House Carino." The staff blazed like a sun. "That's a weapon," Shaddam bellowed, standing up. "Stop him, but take him alive." The Sardaukar rushed forward, clubs and blades drawn. Repha looked startled, waving his jeweled staff. "No, this isn't how I meant for it to happen." The Sardaukar were almost upon him, and Repha seemed to reach a sudden decision. He adjusted the gem. "I only wanted to make my case." A beam shot out from the prop, and Jessica lurched to one side. Lady Anirul toppled her own chair, throwing herself to the floor. The focused glow globe had emitted a deadly laser blast. A nearby Sardaukar guard crashed into the Emperor's chair, knocking Shaddam aside while the fiery blow shattered the guard's chest into cinders. The audience screamed. The Jongleur acting company fled to the rear of the stage, looking at Repha in astonishment. Ducking behind props to avoid a volley of Sardaukar fire, Tyros Repha swung his faceted glow globe, slicing with the laser as if it were a long, hot knife. Abruptly, the burst of blinding light sputtered out. The power source in the ruby brooch drained. Sardaukar guards poured across the stage and surrounded the man who claimed to be Elrud's son. Attendants dragged the shaken but uninjured emperor to safety behind the ruined imperial box. A young theater usher assisted Anirul, her daughters, and Jessica. Emergency response teams rushed in to extinguish the smoldering fires. In the corridor outside the Imperial box, a Sardaukar officer strode forward, his face grim. "We have captured him, sire." Shaddam looked stunned and ruffled. A pair of valets brushed off his Imperial cape, while another smoothed his pomaded hair. The Emperor's green eyes turned cold, more angry than frightened by his brush with death. "Good." Plucking at his chest, Shaddam rearranged the glittering medals he had awarded himself for past accomplishments. "See that you arrest every person involved here. Somebody made a huge blunder with these jongleurs." "It will be done, sire." The Emperor finally looked over at his wife and Jessica, who stood nearby with his daughters, all unharmed. He showed no relief, just processed the information. "Well, in a sense, perhaps I should reward the man," the Emperor mused, trying to lighten the tension. "At least we don't have to watch any more of that dull play." In a technological culture, progress may be viewed as the attempt to move more quickly into the future, rushing to make known the unknown. Mother Superior Harishka. The mysterious Bene Gesserit Mother School had been a peculiar experience for the three Richesian inventors, but Halloa Rund could not say exactly why. For some reason, the trip to Wallach 9 seemed unreal. The return shuttle approached the laboratory satellite of Corona. Rund sat meekly in a passenger seat, wondering if the Bene Gesserit would actually commission their large-scale project from his uncle, Count Ilban Rachiz. The Sisterhood could certainly afford to pay for technical assistance with their power systems. The work would be a boon for the Rachizian economy. Oddly, though, Rund couldn't remember exactly what he and his companions had actually done on Wallach 9. It had been an exhausting trip, with many meetings. They had worked up detailed plans and suggestions for the sisters, hadn't they? Director Kinnis and bookish Talis Bault must still have the plans in their crystal boards. A stickler for schedules, Kinnis tracked the activities of all his lab employees to the nanosecond, using dictation cards that he always kept in his pocket. Whatever the bureaucrat didn't have on his crystal boards, Talis Bault would surely remember. But something inside Run's mind seemed slippery. Every time he tried to remember any specific conversation or particular design proposal he had made, his grasp of the subject slid sideways. He had never been so distractible before. In fact, he had always been obsessively focused, thanks in part to his minimal Mentat background. Now, as their ship docked against the orbiting satellite, he had a vague memory of looking over facilities on Wallach 9. He and his colleagues had been inside the famed school, and he must have been paying attention. He did remember a sumptuous banquet the sisters had thrown for them, the best meal he'd ever eaten. But he couldn't recall any of the items on the menu. Neither Bault nor Kinnis seemed perturbed, already discussing completely different work. The men didn't mention the Bene Gesserit at all, focused instead on improving the manufacturing techniques for valuable Rachizian mirrors in the orbital laboratory. As he and his colleagues disembarked into the Corona research facility, Rund felt as if he were awakening from a bad dream. He turned around, disoriented, realizing that none of them had any luggage or personal articles with them. Not now, anyway. Had they packed any? Glad to be back in the satellite lab facility, and eager to plunge into his continuing research and development work, he found himself tempted to forget anything to do with the Sisterhood. He resented the lost time, but wasn't sure precisely how long he had been gone. He would have to check. Walking beside Rund through the metal corridors, Flinto Kinnis and Talis Bault blinked in the harsh light. Struggling to think back to the Bene Gesserit banquet, Rund sensed fragments of thoughts filtering into the edge of his consciousness, like water seeping through a crack in a dike. He tried to use some of the Mentat techniques he had attempted to learn long ago, but each time it was like grasping a moss-slicked rock. He wanted to know more. If the break became larger, perhaps the troublesome memory block would crumble away. A cold feeling of dread weighed on him, and he began to feel dizzy. This wasn't right. His ears rang. Did the witches do something to us? He began to lose his balance on rubbery legs. Before his companions could help him, Rund slumped onto the cool metal deck. His ears kept ringing. Leaning over the fallen man, Talis Bault wrinkled his smooth forehead. "What is it, Haloa? You want a medic?" Kinnis pursed his lips. "Perhaps a furlough, Rund. I'm sure your uncle would allow it." He seemed to be reassessing schedules in his mind. "I doubt the Bene Gesserit were serious about contracting our services anyway." Confused and alarmed, Rund seized on the comment. "Our services for what, Director?" The recent days were foggy shadows. How could he have forgotten so much so soon? "Do you remember?" The bureaucrat sniffed. "Why, for their project, of course. What does it matter? A wasted effort, if you ask me." To Run's mind, it seemed that his eyes had turned inward. revealing flashes of a Bene Gesserit woman, her lips phrasing harsh questions that echoed in his head. He saw her mouth opening and closing in slow motion, uttering strange words, her long fingers moving hypnotically. He used Mentat mnemonics, focusing techniques. Moment by moment, the crack in the mental dike widened. He remembered Tan Cliffs, a rock quarry, a crashed ship, a specific comment. "You were friends of Chobin." Abruptly, the mental block crumbled and broke, revealing everything. "Tell us what you know of this invention. How do we recreate it?" Still seated in the corridor, Rund began shouting commands. "Bring me a holo recorder, now! I need to get these details down." "He's gone crazy," Director Kinnis lamented. "Something snapped." But Talis Bault snatched one of the dictation cards from the bureaucrat's pocket and handed it to his colleague. Rund grabbed it. "This is important. No time for questions before I lose contact." Without looking at either of his companions, he activated the voice pickup and spoke into it in a breathless rush. "Tenu Chobin, his secret projects were of much concern to Premier Kalimar. He disappeared, defected to House Harkonnen. Too many gaps in the records he left behind. Ah, now we know what he was working on. A generator for an invisibility field." Bault knelt next to him, his smooth brow furrowed. Kenneth looked as if he still wanted to call for medics and drugs, and a relief ship to take the inventor down to Richie's. Kinnis didn't like problems that unsettled the workforce, but he had to take a light touch with the Count's nephew. More images flooded into Run's mind, and his words came out rapid-fire. "He used his field generator to make a warship invisible. Harkonnen's crashed it into the mother school. That is why we were brought to Wallach 9, to help them understand the incredible technology." Flinto Kinnis had heard enough. "Nonsense. We were summoned to discuss work on a..." "I'm sure I have everything in my notes," Bault added, but then frowned. "Do you remember the quarry?" Rund demanded. "The women who interrogated us? They did something to erase our memories." Clutching the Plaz dictation card, the impatient inventor chattered everything he could remember. A curious crowd began to gather in the satellite corridor. And as Rund painted images from his restored memory, Kinnis and Bault could not tear themselves away. Detail after detail hammered at their doubts, but still they could not remember. Obsessed, Rund demanded more dictation cards and spoke into them for hours, refusing any food or water, until finally he lay on the floor of the corridor, exhausted. His work had only just begun. He who laughs alone at night does so in contemplation of his own evil. Fremen Wisdom. Because water was so precious on Arrakis, Rondo Tuic's moisture extraction factories at the Antarctic Cap had made him a wealthy water merchant.